Hello, it's Thursday the 6th of May. I'm Louise Herity. This is Playback Daily and here's just some of what's coming up.
He started down the Class A's, you know, a bit of coke, a bit of opioids. And after I left the country, I went to England and it just got worse and worse and worse.
We have all our tools and equipment and PPE in place and we follow all the rules. That's all we can do. Our product is outdoor, it's spaced apart. You're at the beach, it couldn't be any safer.
It tastes quite similar to coffee. Very often it's mixed with chicory and then that's even more of a coffee flavour. But it does all of the stuff in kind of getting the liver and the gallbladder functioning without any of the kind of excess. Mm-hmm. There's no caffeine.
So. The issue of investment funds buying up entire housing estates has been causing considerable political tremors this week. Green Party leader Eamon Ryan was on Morning Ireland and he discussed the topic with Mary Wilson.
Good morning.
What are you and the government going to do to stop this practice that we're seeing now, where first-time buyers are further forced out of the property market by these deep-pocket investors buying up almost whole estates?
We do have to stop it. We can't have people being frozen out of the market. We need a whole variety of different solutions, but we can't have one investor being able to buy up, as I said, particularly an entire estate. Minister O'Brien indicated, Dara O'Brien, a number of weeks ago, that he was looking to address it. Within, I believe, the best approach is in the planning system, where we can, with regulations, using designating the approach that are taken in different areas, stop the practice, particularly where large estates, as I said, every single house is bought out. It's legally complex and difficult. There are constitutional issues around property, but we will do it. I believe the best approach is through the planning approach, and it'll be Dara O'Brien who set that out. Critically, though, it's part of a wider approach. If we just did that, that wouldn't work. The affordable housing bill and measures introduced yesterday are going to be key. There has to be alternatives too.
We went through the affordable housing bill in some detail over the last 2 days, but staying with stopping these investment funds, are you talking about a ban?
I think you, in the planning system, there's a whole variety of different powers where you can designate or set regulations within conditions within planning permission and so on, so that you restrict the practice.
Can we explore some of those choices? I mean, could you be talking about restricting in the planning process? Could you do this one house, one individual or one couple?
Well, you could say that houses could be sold individually. As said, I don't have the details. It does have to be worked out by the Department of Housing in terms of how it's done. But the government is committed not to allow our housing market become dominated by large institutional investors who freeze the local families out of the market completely.
Okay.
There is a role for those investors. We do need a mix of different solutions. We do need large apartment developments. We need to particularly implement the National Planning Framework, which promotes compact development. Mm-hmm. And that will see a whole variety of measures, including, and critically, the state. The key thing, the reason I mentioned affordable housing in my mind, is that the state also operates, particularly through the use of measures like cost rental housing and apartments, where the state is in the market, where the state helps give people choices. Mm-hmm. And options. The market is not functioning. We cannot rely on it. It is not the key lever to get us out of the housing crisis. It has to be other measures.
Okay. Do you know, or have you received, has the Cabinet received figures, how many houses have been bought up in newly developed housing estates in this country? I'm not talking about apartments now, Minister. I'm talking about houses in housing estates.
I think very, very small numbers. You have to remember the number of these investors.
Do you have a number?
No, but I'd say it's in minimal, no more than 100, 200 or that sort of small number, hundreds.
Well, we know now that there's all but 35 of the houses in Maynooth, so that's about 145
houses. It's not widespread, and we have to stop it becoming widespread.
And when will you stop it? How quickly can you move?
Dara O'Brien will move as quickly as he can within the legal constraints. It may require legislation. It does take time when you're addressing changes in the planning system, but the government is committed to doing that, and at the same time, rolling out the whole variety of different housing options we need.
Green Party leader and Minister Eamon Ryan on Morning Ireland today. And later, the same issue was among the topics Claire Byrne tackled with Minister for Higher Education Simon Harris. And she started by asking if he believed investment funds have a role to play in the housing market in this country.
Of course they do, but they certainly don't have the role to play that we saw in Maynooth at the weekend. And I think that's the very, very big difference. You are right to say that Michael Noonan and indeed the Fine Gael Labour government of the time brought in measures to encourage private investment to bring about housing supply. We don't need a history lesson, but we know that there was very, very, very little supply and we needed to go through every possible avenue to increase supply. And indeed, we saw an increase in supply as a result of that. But it was never, ever the intention, nor can it be tolerated, that you would see private investment funds coming in here and basically swooping up effectively completed housing estates from under the noses of first-time buyers.
So why wasn't it fixed before now?
Well, I think if you remember back in 2019 and the Dáil proposals were brought forward by the now Housing Minister, that did pass second stage in 2019, so the first stage of that legislation. And then obviously everybody knows what happened in 2020 in terms of obviously a global pandemic. We are now moving very, very swiftly in relation to this. I think you've heard from the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, the Minister for Finance, the Leader of the Green Party, the Minister for Housing. There's absolute clarity across government and across three parties in government that we want to act quickly in relation to this. Yeah. It mightn't be a popular thing to say, but I'm not here to be popular. I'm here to tell the truth that private investment funds did help increase housing supply, but it was never, ever the intended consequence that what we saw in Maynooth, which has cut deep, I think, with people right across this country, would be tolerated, and it won't be tolerated by this government.
Yeah, but it does seem as though the door is being bolted here while the horse is galloping off down the road. I was reading Richard Curran today in the Irish Independent saying that the Exchequer might have needed this help from these investment funds while we were in crisis. But he makes the point that the Exchequer has reaped over 18 billion euro in corporation tax receipts above the long-term average since 2015. Now, there should have been a point between 2015 and now where we would have said we need to stop this from happening. We need to stop the possibility occurring that these guys can come in and buy up a housing estate in Maynooth.
I think that's a fair point, but let's not forget the actions that Minister Donoghue took in, I think it was his last budget, in terms of further tightening up the tax treatment for these international
not
investment
enough.
Funds.
Not
but,
enough.
But I'm not disagreeing with you. The government is very clear that it's not enough. And that's why the government will be moving to take swift action to make sure
we can. But you are the government.
We are the government.
Do you see what I'm saying? Every single one of you are saying, since this happened, since this was reported in the Business Post, gosh, this is terrible. How did this happen?
No, that's not right, Claire. That's a misrepresentation, respectfully, of the government's position. The government's position is very clear in relation to this. Institutional investment by private funds has significantly increased supply, particularly of apartments. And I have a load of figures here which I won't go through, but particularly around apartment units, we have seen a number of additional housing supply, a number of extra housing supplies come on stream as a result of private investment. We have taken measures to further tighten that up through Pascal Donoghue's budgets, and now we're saying we need to do even more. But I should point out, because it is an important part of the context, that residential units owned by institutions in Ireland accounts for 0.75% of total housing stock. The government wants to level the playing field for first-time buyers. This week we've published, and Dara O'Brien has published, a really exciting affordable housing bill. We probably haven't had a chance this week because of the Maynooth situation to even get into the detail in relation to that, understandably. But for the very first time, we're trying out new and radical, quite frankly, proposals in relation to housing, including the first ever national cost rental scheme in our country, getting direct local authority affordable homes built for the first time in over a decade, a new shared equity scheme for new built homes, and expanding Part 5. Yeah. So we've come
Which
forward
the
with an
Central Bank isn't happy about.
Well, no, I think, again, I don't speak for the central bank, but I think the central bank has expressed a view as to how you need to do that correctly and what you need to be aware of and cautious of, and government will be. But the point here is we're going to get a piece of legislation into the Dáil now very quickly. It's a really ambitious bill that Dara O'Brien has brought forward, and we're open to suggestions. You know, we're not the font of all wisdom here. We're open to engaging, and if we can improve the bill and make it even better and even more robust, let's do this. But after a pandemic that has worsened an already bad situation in relation to supply, it's important now that we take new actions and new measures, and that's what we're trying to do with this affordable housing bill.
And it's extraordinary that at the parliamentary party meeting, your own one last night, there was a suggestion that Dara O'Brien, the Fianna Fáil housing minister, would be invited to that meeting on the 19th of May to explain what's going on, because it seems as though members in your own party are deeply unhappy with how this is playing out and how it might play out politically for you down the line.
Well, I think we need to be really clear about not personalising this. I mean, I'm not sure how much longer in this country we're going to go around personalising the issue to one minister or one department. The housing situation is one of the biggest societal challenges we face. It involves everybody in government stepping up, all three parties. Even my own department has a role to play in relation to student accommodation. Dara O'Brien is bringing forward new proposals. They're not just his proposals or Fianna Fáil proposals or Fine Gael. They're the proposals of all three parties in government. And Dara has very kindly agreed to come and brief our parliamentary party colleagues on those actions, and also to hear proposals and to hear ideas. And I think that's a good thing to do in a government that wants to work together.
So what will happen? Will there be a complete ban on investment funds buying up housing estates, as we have seen? Will you need emergency legislation for that?
So literally today, as we speak, there are continuing ongoing engagements between a number of government departments to work out what the options are. And I don't want to get ahead of that, but I do expect an update very quickly, as in within a matter of days, in relation to this situation. What government has said is we do not want to see a repeat of the Maynooth scenario. There is a role for international investors. There's a role for private investment in housing supply. Of course there is. And we've seen the benefits of that. The state can't do everything. But not allowing what is an unintended consequence in terms of what we saw in Maynooth. So you will see measures being brought forward, and it's going to require a number of government departments working together.
You see, this is a very fundamental thing. You're saying that we need international investment to build houses for our own people in our own country. That is fundamental, because the argument is there, given those Exchequer figures that I read out from Richard Curran's article, that we don't need that money now. We may have needed it, as he says, in 2014, 2015, 2016, but we don't need that money now if we were spending what we have ourselves in the right way and building houses.
I think we're certainly a lot less reliant on this as a country than we were previously. When we had back in 2012 only 5,000 housing units being built in that year, we saw obviously housing supply significantly ramp up. We've now seen the impact of the COVID pandemic. The policy of this government, contrary to how it's often misrepresented by our political opponents, is to invest very significantly from an Exchequer point of view in housing. More council-built houses, affordable homes, national equity scheme. But I am making the point that we don't want to see what happened in Maynooth happen again, and let there be no confusion, lack of clarity, lack of understanding in relation to that.
But you're still very clear on the point, and you've made it a couple of times. We need international money from private investment companies, those guys who are out to make a buck, let's put it plainly. We need them to build houses in this country.
No, I'm making the point, just to be really clear, I'm making the point that private investment in housing supply has always been an element of the Irish property market. Remember, we have a whole variety of ways of delivering housing in Ireland, and indeed in most other countries. There'll be social houses, there'll be affordable houses, and there'll be private
homes. But you're very careful to qualify this by saying we need that investment coming from international sources, just to be clear for people.
I'm not specifically talking about international sources, but I'm talking about the fact that there will always be a role for private investment in housing supply. And I think to say anything else might sound populist, might be popular, but isn't the truth. I mean, the reality of the situation is housing in pretty much, you know, in most countries in the world is delivered through a variety of mechanisms. We're going to significantly ramp up social housing supply, but we're also going to make sure that we can continue to see privately built homes in our country that many people will want to buy. And in fact, when I talk to many of my constituents across my county of Wicklow, they want to see more social houses. Yes, they want to see more affordable houses. And they also want to see more housing supply so that they and their families have more options in terms of buying a home.
Minister Simon Harris on Today with Claire Byrne. As the easing of lockdown restrictions starts from next Monday, the season of summer tourism looks set to begin. With thousands of people a day expected to visit the Aran Islands, reporter Brian O'Connell was on Inish Moor to see how the locals are feeling. He had this report on Today with Claire Byrne.
Morning, Brian.
You jealous?
I am, because you picked a good day for it.
Stunning day, Claire. Clear blue waters. I took the Aran Islands ferry from Rossaville out to Inishmore, the biggest of the Aran Islands. Population is about 800 to 900. They're expecting multiples of that, as you said, arriving each day, probably mostly for day trips, but some overnight trips as well. There was just 18 on the ferry I took yesterday, and there's a new service due to launch from Galway City, I understand, in the coming weeks with a state-of-the-art vessel. And then there's also, as we know, services from Doolin and, of course, the flights every day. Now, from business owners on the island, as you would expect, they're hugely enthusiastic about tourists coming back to the Aran Islands. And that tourist infrastructure, I hadn't been there in 20 years, and it's incredible. incredible to see how that infrastructure has developed over the past two decades. But it's been a very tough year, as we know. Some islanders, though, think perhaps that the ramping up of visitors is happening just that little bit too quickly over the coming weeks. Now, I suppose let's start with the positives. And one of the issues in recent years, locals will tell you in the Aran Islands, is that there was this issue around day trippers, not enough people staying overnight and spending. Accommodation has been the big issue. So a business set up in 2016, Aran Island Camping and Glamping. Glamping, as we know, is sort of posh camping, isn't it? And they have these glamping pods, Claire. They can sleep 4 to 6 people, 6 feet from the beach, fully booked out until the autumn, would you believe? And I got a tour around with manager Frankie Moore, and we did talk about whether the time is now right to begin opening up the island to mass tourism.
We're located 6 feet from the beach, the beautiful Frenchman's Beach, beautiful sandy beach. And, you know, today especially, it's absolutely gorgeous. Like, we're just so lucky. We really are blessed.
And it's so tranquil on the island now. Obviously, I mean, there were maybe 20 people on the ferry coming over. So there's a trickle, but it obviously hasn't started yet.
It's been slow. There's been a couple of people each day, maybe renting a bike and touring the island. But we're all gearing up for summer. We just cannot wait to see people here on the island again.
Now, tell me what we're looking at here on the left-hand side.
So, this is our site. So what we're looking at here is the glamping section. We have 24 rooms in our glamping site. You can hear the workmen there making a lot of noise. So there's major maintenance going on all over our site at the moment as we prepare to open.
Tell me about advance booking. What's demand like?
Well, we were very lucky this year. We thought it was going to be very difficult to get bookings, but we're now fully booked straight through until the end of September. We have all our tools and equipment and PPE in place, and we follow all the rules. That's all we can do. Our product is outdoor, it's spaced apart, you're at the beach. It couldn't be any safer. Enough of the doom and gloom. We can do this as long as we're safe and follow the rules.
But there was that bit of tension, wasn't there, last year, where people felt too many people were coming onto the island at once?
There's a big difference between last year and now. We didn't have enough information. Everybody was terrified last year. There was no vaccines. There's an elderly population on this island, and nobody wants anyone to get sick or die. So it was a very stressful time. But now we've a lot more information. It's time to get positive again and start moving forward.
Frankie Moore in there on the camping and glamping. You'd like the glamping now, Brian. Nice, luxurious camping.
Says yourself.
Well, she's saying there that it's time to get on with it. You can understand why. You also called to the local GP.
Like I said, huge changes on the island. There is some apprehension about some of those, wondering if a more cautious approach might be better. Local island GP is Dr. Marion Broderick. Now, we met in her garden yesterday, and she told me that while she obviously acknowledges that people need to get back earning, she was nonetheless apprehensive when I asked her how she was feeling about the prospect of a very busy tourist summer ahead.
Well, I know it's going to be very busy, and I know all the businesses are fully booked out, and good luck to them. I would hope that we'll get the same kind of nice tourism this year that we did last year, because it was largely family groups. It's good for tourism, it's good for people to be able to travel and get out, but taking people from one end of the country to the other in all directions is probably a very good recipe for spreading infection as well. Well, many of the elderly patients are quite apprehensive about the island opening up. I would know some of the elderly people who would try and go to the shop very, very early in the morning, and certainly wouldn't go again until after the boat had left at 5 o'clock. You know, people are apprehensive, but at the same time, we recognise that the country has to open up. The beginning of the end has to happen somewhere. I would be concerned, because I know we'll get very, very large numbers, and probably more numbers than the island can cope with if last year was anything to go by. My personal feeling is, if it were possible to do it, that maybe we should have waited for another few weeks until more people were vaccinated. We must immediately debunk the myth that the whole island has been vaccinated. That's not true.
And then the idea that the island has remained COVID-free.
Well, that's another myth. We certainly have had cases, fortunately not very many.
The big difference between this year and last year are the vaccines. Mm-hmm.
Certainly the big difference between this year and last year are the vaccines, and people who were really seriously worried last year are still apprehensive, but they're less worried than they were last year.
All right, so some apprehension there from Dr. Marion Broderick, saying that there's apprehension amongst the population there as well. But the numbers on the ferries, Brian, they'll be limited.
Yes, for example, that new service I mentioned from Galway City, I think it takes 90 minutes. It can take 400 people on that ferry, and obviously it won't be taking that kind of number for the next few weeks. I spoke with Noreen Darcy from the Aran Island Ferries, and she pointed out to me a COVID charter the ferries have agreed to around the various steps and measures in place, just to ensure passengers are travelled safely. Bookings are quite brisk already, and they expect, I suppose, when accommodation providers open up on the island, it's going to get even busier. Before I left the island, I did want to drop in, Claire, on two businesses, pretty new. Both of them would have had all sorts of business plans and projections, as you can imagine, thrown completely up in the air by COVID. First up was the Dive Academy, run by a Polish family who settled in Ireland many years ago, and they moved from Lahinch to Kilronan. They can teach you snorkeling, you can go scuba diving, you can take you around the island on a kayak, and they're situated right on the pier. And they were about to go kayaking when I met them. And then afterwards, you'll hear from a local man who started a second business called the Aran Off-Road Experience.
We're going kayaking. We got two kayaks for two people and go around the bay, nice and calm, catch some sunshine.
So you've had tougher Wednesdays, have you?
Absolutely. You can't complain now with this.
So you moved here 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'd imagine you had a business plan.
Oh yeah, yeah.
How did the business plan look last year?
Well, we didn't plan that actually. We survived and we just can't wait to reopen.
What's your expectation? Because you would have an idea from bookings, I'd imagine, of what the season is going to be like.
The last year was very busy, and this year it looks like gonna be even busier than last year. The season last year was only 2.5 months for us. This year we have a lot longer. Yeah, looks very promising. Looks very promising.
Tell us your name.
Angus Herninger.
Tell me about the business.
Well, Aran Off-Road Experience is a business we set up last year, myself and my brother Porrick. It's really about taking small numbers or small group to hard-to-reach areas on the island. Now, we have a unique vehicle for that. It's a 4x4 Land Rover Defender converted to seat 11 people. And two separate cabins.
Is there a tipping point, and it might be a hard question for you to answer, but because you're living on the island, but is there a tipping point where mass tourism becomes unsustainable?
That probably would have been an issue more so before COVID, where you would have had maybe 1,000, 1,500 people at day trippers, and they would have left again in the evening. And last year, what we were seeing, that there was a lot more people staying. If anything to go by last year, when we did open up, it should be probably just as busy this year and again.
And the best of luck to the two new businesses there on Inishmore, looking to the season ahead. Now, I heard you were singing sea shanties. Were you with the sea captain? What was going on?
No, don't ask me to sing, but I met a man, Robert Hilton, and he was telling me he's coming up to his 65th anniversary of signing on to his first ship. He's a sea captain. And during his life, he's sailed in many parts of the world. And as you said, I mean, sea shanties are kind of hip now, aren't they? You've all sorts of hipsters sing them if you get a couple of light ales into them. But who better than to sing a real life, than a real life sea captain to sing a sea shanty? I'll give you 30 seconds of Robert singing.
In 1824, on March the 18th day, we hoisted our colours to the top of the mast, and for Greenland bore away, brave boys, and for Greenland bore away. For Greenland is a hell of a place that bears no green, where there's ice and there's snow and the whale fishes.
God, you got the real deal there, Brian, from
Fantastic.
Robert Hilton. Yeah, and you're going to tweet all of the details of the businesses, the people you met up on Twitter. You also managed to get on a plane.
Oh, it was magnificent to be sitting on a plane, to be waiting to get on, to get on board, purely for research purposes. I was on the Air Aran flight back. Myself and six other passengers, one of whom was a family who had their pet dog. He was nearly licking my ear. He was sitting on their lap behind me. Spectacular view, so I'll tweet a little video of that. Relatively cheap weight course to get off the island and get on the island. Probably might be the only flight I'm going to take for a while, I'm afraid.
Well, it sounds like you had a great day, Brian. Thanks very much for bringing us that.
That was Brian O'Connell's report on Today with Claire Byrne. Earlier on Morning Ireland, in her final report looking at racism in Ireland, social affairs correspondent Alva Keneally looks at how one Cork school has achieved integration among students and teachers.
When you say proud of himself, what do you mean by that? Why would he feel proud of himself, do you think? religious studies at Bishopstown Community School. Here, when students look around the class, they see different colours and cultures in their peers. It's evident, too, at the top of the classroom.
We're going to leave question three for a moment and we're going to go straight on to question four.
Conor McNamara is Roma by birth. He and his twin brother were adopted by their parents in Tipperary town at 10 months old.
I suppose we were kind of very much integrated into Irish culture. So that was a big part for us, the fact that we went to a Gaelic school, the fact that we played Irish games, we played GA, and, you know, Sean O'Gahalpin, when I was younger, was a massive inspiration to me. One, because he was a Gaelic goer, and two, he was the only person that looked like him, his brothers, that looked like my brother and I. So, following him as a young kid, he really inspired me. It made me think that, you know, I could be a GA star, I could be successful, I could do anything I want to do, and still, even though I look different, I could still be as Irish as anyone else.
Both brothers became teachers, and today the classroom is different to the one they experienced growing up.
We were in the minority in terms of physical appearance. Now, not how we felt in our souls, in our hearts, we felt Irish, you know. But definitely we knew we were different, we knew we looked different. So I think nowadays kids, they can look around the classroom and say, well, that person, but, you know, there's three or four people they have a point of reference to. It'll take a bit more time for those generations to come through. But there definitely is a discrepancy in terms of what's in front of the teacher and what's in front of the student.
And what's in front of the students is important, particularly if they're from minority backgrounds. Mariam Malotiku and Jakob Paco are fifth-year students. Mariam is also chair of the student council.
Even seeing Mr. McNamara as like the physical embodiment of working hard, beating whatever stigmas that one may face, being different, I think it's very important seeing someone like that in a position that he is. It gives you a lot of inspiration for opportunity in your own life.
As much as the school is small, it contains a lot of spirit, you know, like essence to cling on to. It's like a family almost. And that's what I think people from different backgrounds and cultures can bring. Another layer to build on with a student, like a teacher-student relationship. That's why I would want to become a teacher.
And future teachers like Jakob are encouraged through the school's career guidance. There's recognition of the value they could bring to classrooms in the future, like what Mr. McNamara is bringing to their classroom today. Here's the principal of the school, Edwina Gottstein.
Providing those role models to students adds to the rich experience for their post-primary education. So I suppose it's a conversation that has started in the school. And Mariam, as chairperson of the student council, would constantly converse with me about that idea of representation and representation of people of colour in media and in teaching and in SNA and all the different roles in a school. So I suppose more needs to happen in that area for students to be able to identify with those particular role models.
And by seeing role models in the education system from all backgrounds, the Children's Ombudsman believes this will lead to a more equal society. Niall Muldoon has had to highlight that children from direct provision have experienced racism in school from both pupils and teachers.
Listening to the children, we deliberately wanted to ask them what was the community of Ireland like for them, how welcoming had it been. And they were very clear that they'd suffered racism. Every group of children we spoke to had suffered racism in different ways. So those sorts of things just need to be raised in our consciousness. You know, and I think across the education system we need to start looking at trying to get diversity into the teaching profession. We need to look and work very hard at being proactively anti-racist and progressively integrative and looking for diversity in everything we do. We need to keep working harder at that, and I think that has to happen across the whole community and across the education system, particularly at the moment.
But is it the job of schools to resolve inequalities? Professor of Migration and Social Policy in UCD, Brian Fanning.
I think it's a wider job for government. I think it's a wider job for local leadership. I think it's a wider job for localities. I think we're in a very good starting place in the sense that, you know, there's an awful lot of positives in Irish society. At the same time, we're very good at brushing problems under the carpet at times. And I would hate to think that this generation will be castigated as the generation that pushed the problem of racism under the carpet.
Professor Brian Fanning ending the report by Alva Keneally for Morning Ireland. And you can hear all of Alva's reports from the series on the RTE Radio 1 website. It's hard to believe, but many of the plants in our garden are edible. From dandelion coffee to elderflower cordial, there's so much to explore. But what is in season for you to forage right now? Fiona Newlawn, the holistic gardener, and Sharon Green from Wild Irish Foragers joined Claire Byrne to fill her in.
Fiona, I'll start with you because you're here in front of me. You say that we should look no further than our gardens. But the thing is, we just sometimes don't know what we're looking for.
Yeah, well, it's that thing again, because we've had the kind of 5K limit, and I know stuff is changing. Some of us have had no choice but the garden and the local park, and your limited availability there. But just in terms of your garden, I mean, all of the weeds that pretty much would colonise a lawn on a border are edible plants and have had a long history as both medicinal and edible plants in their own right. And some of them are remnants of kind of monastic settlements, like stuff like fat hen that was traditionally used as a pot herb. Nettles. Nettles have, you know, a long, long history as an edible plant.
Yeah, I mean, my brother taught me when I was about six how to grasp a nettle. I'd be afraid to do it now, but you're doing it, right?
I do it now because, look, my grandfather said to me when I was a very young child that the old Irish adage about tree nettles in May wards off all illness for the rest of the year. So while we often talk about kind of spring tonics, nettles are a brilliant summer tonic. And what they ward off is nettles are antihistamine. So at this time of the year, when the tree pollen is coming in and people are back out using their gardens and they're having pollen sensitivity, having a meal of nettles in this month is building up an immunology against that.
What do you do with them? Soup?
So, well, I mean, the quickest way to get it into your system is make a nettle tea, pick a few leaves, put it in a cup, pour in some boiling water, leave it for 3 to 4 minutes. The leaf solids can go onto your compost heap and it's a brilliant soil activator. Mm-hmm. And then sip the liquid. There's plenty of iron in there to battle off anemia, and there's plenty of kind of rutin and camphor, which are the antihistamines. Next thing you can do is you can have it in a pesto. So just swap your basil content out for the nettles. Nettles is also a spinach substitute, so you can have it in a Spanish omelette, or you could have it in your lasagna. There's just loads of fabulous ways to include it as a vegetable.
Sharon, are you into the nettles?
I am. We're almost finished our nettle picking season here. And what Fionn said, we do all of the above, so to speak. Another thing people can do actually in their gardens as well is, you know, as a nettle gets older, it gets stronger and it starts to produce an acid. So you don't really, when they get dark green, you're not supposed to pick them.
Okay.
But if you have them in your garden somewhere and you take them this time of the year and you cut them back, if you leave it 6 weeks, you'll have a new growth and you can start using them again. As long as you don't pick them when they're very quite bright green and not really, if you take the marker of not above 4 inches high.
Right. Will you just bring us back to basics and tell us how to grasp a nettle?
Me?
Yes.
I'm actually immune to grasping nettles. I don't get a sting at all.
Really?
But the thing about the nettle sting, and like Fionn mentioned, the heritage sizing, people would go out and pick the nettles. Nettles, the sting is actually good for your circulation.
I don't know about that. I was three and I still do remember this. I fell into a thicket of nettles, right? And I was stung from head to toe. So I wouldn't be mad about nettle stings, I have to say, even though you're telling me now I'd be fine. I wouldn't be looking for a nettle sting, put it like that.
Yeah. Well, I found my kids now, when we would be out picking nettles when they were younger, and they'd be kind of, I don't want to get stung, I don't want to get stung. And what I used to say was, don't think about it. And it worked. So
Fionn,
there's a kind of psychological thing.
Well, I err on the side of marigold gloves or gardening gloves.
Okay.
You know, I'm not that brave. I know
I
the ancient
don't mind them at all.
The ancient Vikings used to whip themselves with nettles to get this kind of histamine and serotonin surge to go into battle. But
right.
That's not my style.
No. Okay, fair enough.
Do you know something I should say to tell you about? There was an old, you know, when a nettle gets older and it goes to seed, I found a very old story about what the nettle seeds were used for years ago. They're full of energy, and I'm not advocating anybody picks them because you have to get the little white seed out. It's quite difficult. The dust can get up into your nose. But years ago, they were known as the dodgy horse dealer's secret trick. So if you had an old kind of half-beaten nag at home and he wanted to take to the market to sell it, he'd pick nettle seed and he'd put it into its feed that morning. So what you had is an old mare that the previous night became a young filly at the market, and she was sold. But by the time the new owner got her back home, she was gone back to where she was
before. So the nettle seeds would like give the horse energy and a bit put a bit of a smile on her face.
Yeah, yeah. There were all the dodgy horse dealer's secret trick.
Love it. That's a good one. Listen, the gorse. We see all the beautiful yellow colour around the countryside, Sharon. What can we do with that? What can we use it for?
Well, with the gorse, well, normally I would use it for making a syrup, but you can use the flowers in salads. And if you mix the flowers into ice cream, soften down your ice cream, mix the flowers, and it gives a lovely coconutty flavour. When you're going out to pick them, be careful where you'll see loads of them along the roadside and that. They're full of pollution. Don't go near those. Find a quiet area. If you just snip the top of them, maybe about 6 inches, the top where the head is full, and come home and in your own leisure then pick off the flowers because they're quite thorny. What you can do then is, and what we do here when we finish picking the gorse, we put the heads into the back of the shed and let them dry out. And they're the best fire lighter for your stove in the winter in the world.
And Fionn, what do you do with the gorse? Do you pick them? Do you forage?
Yeah, I pick gorse. I pick gorse to make syrups and cordials the same way. In a couple of weeks' time now, the hedgerow will be just fizzing with elderflower and people will be going out looking to make their elderflower cordial or their elderflower champagne. Elderflower cordial is literally, you know, sugar, lemon juice, citric acid. Your champagne, you can get the champagne yeast and turn it into a champagne. Mm-hmm. What I want to experiment with this year is to get the Scoobies and try and make a kombucha, you know, make a fermented tea and try and add in flavours there. And gorse, because gorse has that kind of coconut pineapple smell, I find it intriguing that something grows in Ireland with this real tropical kind of fragrance.
Have you ever heard the gorse called a whinbush?
It's the same thing. Sometimes it's called whin and sometimes it's called force.
Because my husband calls it, I'd never heard that before, he calls it the whin bush. Sharon, you want to come in there on that one?
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to say, I have a lot of people this coming up this year would say to me, do you know when they have to go to the pharmacy and get citric acid?
Yeah.
And they say, well, what can I use? I don't go and get the citric acid and put into it. Just so people know that a quarter of a teaspoon of citric acid, you can replace that with a tablespoon of ordinary lemon juice. You don't need to be going to get this citric acid powder.
Okay, that's a good tip. Let's move on then. What else are you picking? Is wild garlic over now, or are we still in wild garlic season?
Our wild garlic now is more or less gone to seed.
It's gone.
Yeah, for this area. What I'm kind of on for home use now is cleavers.
Okay, explain that to me now.
Cleavers, people would know them as goosegrass, sticky backs.
Do you know sticky backs. Oh, yeah. Those. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. they've got a fantastic flavour. You can use them just as you use, say, basil. Mm-hmm. Or if you add a half a cup of them to rice and it's cooking, it gives a lovely flavour.
To rice? And,
yeah. They give a lovely flavour to it. Now, they're full of nutrition. Absolutely full of it.
Okay, we used to just play with those things and we used to throw them at one another. Yeah,
yeah. But it turns out they're a fantastic lymphatic tonic, and you can just soak them in water overnight, and the chemicals leach into the water, and it gets your lymphatic system
and drink open it.
And drink it. It gives a nice kind of grassy flavour, you know, which some people find nice. And this is the interesting thing about when you're foraging. It's when you get the plant, the part can be treated so many different ways. Anything from a tea to a water infusion to infusing in oils that will bring out different types of chemicals. And that includes kind of when you're making your pestos and that sort of stuff. And then there's ones that you can actually cook. So with the wild garlic, I find this year, because of the 5K, I was very limited in finding wild garlic. But what I found all across Dublin was tree-cornered leek. Now, tree-cornered leek is a plant that came in the 1900s as a garden plant. Like many of the plants that have escaped out and are kind of colonising places, it's pretty much everywhere. So when you're picking it, you're actually doing a favour. Often when I'm talking about foraging, I'm saying, look, don't really strip the hedgerow. Leave something, not just for the next person coming along, but for the wildlife to seed on. So with stuff like the tree-cornered leek, it's called tree-cornered leek because the leaves are folded over and they make, like, you know, those old kind of hats that they used to have with the kind of tree corners. Yeah. So that's what it looks like. But it smells of garlic, it tastes of garlic. Like wild garlic, the flower is edible, the leaf is edible, and the bulb is edible. So that's it.
Called a leek, but tastes like garlic.
But it's an allium, so it's in the family of leeks, shallots, onions, garlic, that sort of stuff.
Okay.
You know.
This listener, Tony in Dundalk, is brewing dandelion wine at the moment, and he says they're plentiful. They always are. Is that something that either of you would do with the dandelion?
Yeah, we do a lot with dandelions here. We make a dandelion honey, which is called dandelion honey. It was known in Ireland as poor man's honey. So when the honey reserves were low, people used to go out and pick the petals off the dandelions and make it as a honey alternative.
And how do you do it? What do you put in it? Sugar?
Yeah, it would be sugar base. Yeah, with the dandelion petals. Another way you can actually use the dandelion honey is if you have honey at home. If you pick dandelions and stir them into the honey and leave it sit for 2 weeks, it's great to use in a herbal tea.
Okay, so you just put a spoonful of it into hot water or with your tea bag?
With hot water or with your herbal tea bag, yeah.
Okay, and do the petals remain intact once they've been soaked in the honey for 2 weeks?
They more or less remain intact, but they're a very light flavour. They're not something that would get caught in your throat or anything like that. Like they're very soft.
Yeah, and delicate. Fionn, what do you do with dandelions?
Well, what I find fabulous with dandelions is that dandelions, the flower itself, is packed with vitamin A. So it's very rare to find plants potent in vitamin A. So for anybody who's kind of vegan or vegetarian, you know, it's often the meat sources that comes in. So dandelion is really good to get that into your system, but also to make into kind of beauty treatments and cosmetic stuff to treat skin complaints, where vitamin E is very good for everything from scarring through to acne and dry skin. But then the leaf is really good as a salad. And you can blanch the leaf. That's just the way you do it with your rhubarb. Put a pot over it for 2 or 3 days, and that changes the sweetness. It changes the saccharin content contained within the starches. And then later in the year, this is the great versatility of lots of the stuff that are the weeds. You dig up the root, you dry the root, and that's a coffee substitute. So it does
what?
All. Yeah.
Dandelion coffee.
Dandelion. It tastes quite similar to coffee. Very often it's mixed with chicory, and then that's even more of a coffee flavour. But it does all of the stuff in kind of getting the liver and the gallbladder functioning without any of the kind of excess. Mm-hmm. There's no caffeine. So
are you making all of these things yourself, Fionn?
Yeah, just as I go throughout the year, that's what I do. I don't like the idea of weeding, but I like the idea of harvesting the garden. So mm-hmm. whenever I'm picking a weed, I'm conscious that it's a dynamic accumulator that can go on the compost heap, or it's something that I can have in a sandwich for lunch, or it's something that I can make into a herbal tea.
Mm-hmm. Dandelion coffee might just take a bit of getting used to. Finally today on the Ryan Tubridy Show, Ryan heard from Reuben Hester, a musician whose song about his late father has just launched his solo career.
How are you?
Nice to talk to you. How are you doing today?
I'm very good, thank you very much. And yourself?
Good, thank you. Take us to Enniscorthy, where you grew up, mm-hmm. and tell us, if you wouldn't mind, a little bit about life there. And when are we talking about exactly? What are we talking, 90s or beyond?
Yeah, from when I was 3 years of age, I kind of moved there. So it's all I've known until I was 16.
Mm.
Country, kind of small town, borderline village, I'd say. Great times playing out in the fields and, you know, small community. So it was a great place to grow up as a youngster. Went to school there, did everything there. My family, my home is there. My music originated from there. Everything was there. It's a great place, and obviously lots of history. So I love going home every now and then.
And what was your, I was going to say your weapon of choice. What was your instrument of choice as a youngster, Reuben?
my instrument of choice. When I was growing up, it was the cello.
Oh, lovely.
I was like the midget of the school. Like I was tiny and had a massive cello on my back and you should have seen it. It was really something to look at. That was my instrument of choice, per se, at the time anyway. And then I kind of grew out of that and, you know, went into piano and guitar and singing and so on and so forth, I guess.
Give me a bit of a sense of your mum and dad in terms of background, if you can, because we detect a bit of non-Irish accent going on there, and yet you've got Enniscorthy. So where are the genes coming from?
My mum, she's... She has a Manchester accent. She's obviously, her whole family's Irish, but she has a dominant Northern English accent. My dad had a strong Cockney accent, London. He was known as English Kev. Like that was like, oh, English Kev. Everyone knows English Kev because he's big, loud Cockney accent. So I think my accent kind of got lost in translation, a bit mixed up.
Okay, but not at all. It's a nice jumble of who you are. It's not the way it is. And your father was an electrician.
He was.
And his, I suppose, in some ways, your story hits a certain fork in the road when your dad had developed an addiction, essentially. Can you tell me about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was always there. It just wasn't dominant on display for a long time. Like, when I was growing up as a child, you know, I can't remember, he was addicted to speed, and that kind of subsided for a while the older I got, so I wouldn't see as much of it. And then when I was 14, 15, 16, it started kicking back in. So he started down the class A's, you know, a bit of coke, a bit of opioids. And after I left the country, I went to England, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And eventually, I ended up looking after him. He had to come over to England, and he spent the rest of his days over there with me. And obviously, my mother helped me out a hell of a lot, and we tried everything we could. It's obviously a horrible, horrible addiction.
How do you live with that as a young person? How do you see when you see your dad in the state he's in? And I don't mean to be mean about your father, but he just had this addiction.
Of course.
So how do you marry a son's love of his father with a father's mm-hmm. love of a horrible substance that's killing him?
I think it's an adjustment period. I went through an adjustment period over, you know, a long time. And seeing him in that state was like, it kind of became the norm. So you kind of, you know, become numb to seeing it. And when you come home and you're straight to the hospital for an overdose, it's like, oh, it's like, here we go again. It's just, it is again, you know. It's never easy to see that. It's quite hard, in fact. And it was hard, especially for my younger brother, who's also struggling right now with addiction as a byproduct to obviously the trauma of seeing our dad going through what he went through. So it's never easy, but I think dealing with it is, for me, I just turned to music in my spare time when I wasn't dealing with that period. You know, when I wasn't at home looking after him, I'd go on music and I'd write and express my emotions into that. That was my, you know, music was my kind of counsellor.
Yeah, it's very beautifully put. And I think that when you hit 16, 17, 18, and you went over to the UK, your father kind of was over there as well. Your mother and your brother stayed in Enniscorthy, and you eventually. You also get to a point, don't you, as a child, this will really echo with people at home who've been through this experience, where mm-hmm. you have to decide, am I tethered to this man because he's my father?
Yeah.
Or can I have a life of my own?
You know what? You say that perfectly, because before I left, I was like, can I leave? Can I go and pursue what I want to do as a dream? Because if I do, what will happen to him?
Exactly.
You know, I felt like, am I tied to this man? Is it my responsibility? If I leave, will it be my fault? You know, there's all these emotions that come over you. Eventually, I took the decision to look after myself and say, well, I need to make my own life, and what he chooses is his choices, and he's an adult. But to get to that point, to get to that way of thinking, I had to get past a lot of guilt and kind of see past what I would, you know, what I would see every day, which was quite difficult.
Oh, I have no doubt. Actually, even the idea of that dilemma is horrible to think about. But yet, you still have to strive for your independence. He was making those choices as an adult. You can't spoon feed him
That's
as a child. So
100%.
You pursued your music, and you're really, if you don't mind me saying, you think you're a particularly talented musician, and you obviously had something and have something. What did you do mm-hmm. with that talent? Where did you go?
When I arrived in Manchester, I stayed there for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And I was busking on the streets and playing music. I was in college, and I remember not having enough money some days for lunch. I'd run into the city centre, busk, make some money, buy lunch, go back, study music. And I said to myself, I was with my friend, Elmore, and we were like, let's get the bus and let's just go somewhere. And we went to Amsterdam, and was like, let's busk and see what happens. And we made enough money to stay the night. We did another day and another day, and we ended up doing Cologne, Frankfurt, Berlin, Prague. We ended up coming home like almost a year later, and then went for round two, started a band, and obviously everything happened with my dad, so I went solo again, And now I'm kind of being true to myself with my music and writing for me. And that seems to be working the best when I'm doing what's right for me musically and putting out what's close to my heart, I guess.
And you had the people behind The Voice getting in touch with you, and X Factor getting in touch with you, Ruben,
yeah,
saying, look, we think you have something. Come and join, you know, come and do an Ollie Murs and become a superstar by auditioning and so forth. And they wouldn't do that lightly. So you said, did you say no to all of that?
Yeah, I said no. It was like year after year, and I like, come on X Factor, come on this, come on that, and no, until it was only until the Little Mix show got in touch, which I also said no to, but we had a conversation about, you know, the girls have been through the struggle, they know what it's like, and they only want the best for musicians and artists. So I kind of lowered my guard a little bit, and I thought, well, you know, there's no harm in trying. Obviously, ended up going further than I expected, but it was definitely the best thing I ever did. It was a great time.
And that's a program, Little Mix, This Search, where, you know, they're trying to form an R&B group. What did you get out of that experience? I mean,
Well, personally, I mean, you've got Leanne from the show. She's able to message me one-on-one now and give me some guidance, which is great. They've never stopped supporting. I got an experience of what it's like to perform to millions on national TV. I learned kind of, you know, you learn choreograph techniques, stage presence. You spend time with a vocal coach, which, you know, at the time I wouldn't be able to afford. There's so much that you get out of it other than just an audition, which I found incredible. And obviously, you know, you gain a loyal fan base off the back of it.
So, Ruben, let's talk about spinning plates, because as a carer, as a son, as a musician, you're spinning plates.
100%.
You've described perfectly well that the music career is now spinning away nicely there on the right-hand side. But on the left, there's one wobbling on the pole, and that's your father. Take us over to that for a moment and tell us, as your career musically was progressing, as you've been describing it perfectly well, what was happening to that situation?
I think my music career kind of took a dive for a while when that was all going on. And for a long time, it was, I can do both. And my mother would come and fly over from Ireland and help out as well. So, you know, sometimes there was some relief, but that can't last forever. So eventually it crumbled a little bit. And the band that I was in at the time, China Lane, we ended up splitting up because there was just no time for it. So it was difficult in the end. Right, you just have to be strong. I know it's like toxic advice to yourself, but it's like, you know, just be strong. You just have to do everything if you want to be the person you want to be. You just have no choice. So when you're confronted with that and put into a corner, I feel like you can find the strength. Well, I found the strength, which was obviously helpful. Music helped in that strength, but it definitely wasn't easy. And it's not easy now because obviously my brother is now also an addict and he's in and out of rehab, which is not very good, of course. But it's, again, another issue we're dealing with. And right now I'm trying to get more help and raise more awareness about the topic, and it's not easy.
No, I understand that. You've mentioned the band China Lane, and you left the band. Did you become a full-time carer then at that point? Was that about 2019, 2018?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. He had a triple heart bypass, my dad, so it was most of the time he came out of hospital and I'd look after him every day. And then he's on his opioids, and the doctors would be like, I remember my mum took him to the doctor and was like, hey, he's taking too many, stop prescribing him so many drugs. And they just kept giving him more. We went to rehab and they were like, yeah, there's like a 6-month waiting list, so you can't come in here. And it's, you know, it's just, there's not a whole lot of options.
Your dad went to visit your sister, I think, in London for a couple of days.
He did,
in 2019.
He did.
And where were you? Were you in Manchester at that point?
I was in Newcastle that
Newcastle.
Day. I was busking. Yeah, that's the day I got the phone call. He went down for a couple of days, and I was on the streets busking. I remember answering the phone, and his sister's crying, and she's like, "It's happened. You know, it's happened. He's gone." And I remember saying, "You know, it's fine. It's all right. You know." It was bound to happen, trying to calm everybody down. I rang my mum and like, hey, you know, it's fine. Don't worry. Well, obviously, you know, you can't not worry, but, you know, take a breath. tell Rio, my brother, and, you know, let's take it day by day. And I remember putting the phone down, picking my guitar up and carrying on busking like nothing had happened. You know, obviously shock. And
sure.
I remember going out that night as well and listening to music. And I didn't shed a tear for a good month until the funeral. And it was, I think it was shock for a long time.
What did he die of?
Overdose, accidental drug overdose, methadone.
And how old was he?
55.
Yeah, that's shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, it's too young. It's definitely young, man.
And how are you with all of that? Your memory of your dad and your relationship with his story. How would you characterize that?
Yeah, I mean, we had the absolute best relationship before everything happened. We were, you know, best mates. He was big, loud, charismatic, crazy about music, and I like to tell his story. You know, when people ask about him, I don't hide away. When people talk about, you know, oh, what happened, I'm fully open, you know, positive about the situation, and I talk about it with my arms wide open and my heart on my sleeve. I take the good with the bad, and I remember the good parts, and the bad parts, that was a different person.
Sure.
That wasn't him at all, you know.
Yeah, there's an addict and there's a father.
There is. And the good thing is he was never horrible, he was never nasty, and he couldn't hide it at the end, but he was still loving and caring, and he was still a dad, you know.
And you wrote Sold My Soul for him.
I did, yeah. I wrote Sold My Soul for him. I remember writing it in the living room and just filling up with emotion, running around in circles, like singing these lyrics over and over again, and it just all fell out like a jumble of mess, you know, onto pen and paper, onto a pad.
That was Reuben Hester on The Ryan Tubridy Show. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow night. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening. And we'll finish with a sample of Reuben's debut single. This is Sold My Soul.
There is a silence all around, something in the air I can't believe in now. I tried so hard to let it be. God only knows, keeps coming over me. Some days I feel like I'm fighting. Some days I don't feel like writing. Some days I don't feel. The devil's not only a sinner. This city's also a winner. This city's also. I sold my soul to let him know. There's a trouble from underneath, and I'm losing my self-belief. I sold my soul, oh, now he should throw, oh, I'm not giving in. My thoughts, my needs, my selfish ways keep picking me up, I don't know what to say. I really don't know what to do. I'm having trouble, now I'm not here with you. Some days I feel like I'm fighting. Some days I don't feel like writing. Some days I don't feel. The devil's not only a sinner. This city's also a winner. This city's also. I sold my soul to let him know. There's a trouble from underneath, and I'm losing my self-belief. I sold my soul. Now he should.